Old Timers Panel. My name is Jimmy Julian. I'm an alcoholic. Glad to see you all here in the panel here. We're probably waiting for a couple more people. They'll show up shortly. I think there's people next door. Hopefully they can hear us over here. But let's start the meeting off with the Serenity Prayer.
God,
bring me the serenity to accept the things that I can't change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
This is an honor and a privilege for me to do this. My sponsor had to go out of town. My grand sponsor told me to talk nice about him, and I am. He's got his white horse, I think, out there, Tony. But we're going to start off the meeting with Sue Windows, Dr. Bob's daughter.
Unaccustomed as I am, and all that, I think we should take a minute or so to think of some of those that aren't here, like John and Jackie, his wife. They have had a rough time since San Diego. And I think we should also think of Larry Bauer and some of those that we lost this last year. Larry was the one that dubbed me the oldest Alateen, you know, and believe me, I am. I'm the oldest, like that? Okay. Got that ironed out. First of all, I'd like to say that I come from a dysfunctional home, and I live alone. I really did. I came from a dysfunctional home because it was, as you all know, it was a children's home, and I was very lucky to be adopted by Dr. Bob and Ann. And I look around at the people and I think, my golly, I wonder just what they would think if they could see the people that they have helped over the years, and all those that are yet to come. There's so many of them yet. But I'm not too good of a speaker. I do a little bit better on questions. And, you know, we don't have much time. I'd be glad to give my time to somebody else. But I will answer a couple of questions if somebody wants to, if they're not too tough, you know. Anybody got one? What day? He died November 16th, 1950, on a Thursday. Yeah. That's why we try and get this as close to that date as we can. But he was a very tall, slender man. He had steel blue eyes that when he said something and those eyes were a certain color, you did it without any question. And he had a great sense of humor. And he had every Monday night, he had card playing night. That was his night out. And so we had chipped beef every Monday night without fail. And then down to the city club he'd go, and he never lost, he never won. You believe it? All's even. I used to play cards with him out in the kitchen, and we'd be playing cards, I'd finally throw the card that he wanted. He'd say, God almighty, how long you been holding that one? And he knew every card I had in my hand. He used to make me some mad. He would hold his away from me.
You know, after Dr. Bob and his father, together for a while.
Yeah, after Bill and Dan.
Yeah, and after he left, well, how long was it before he came back to this house?
Oh, I think he came back the next summer. I mean, for a visit, not to stay. But he did. He was here 3 months, and of course Smitty and I got shoved up to the attic or down here on the Davenport, depending on what Smitty's plans were for that evening. If he was, sometimes he'd go to the fraternity house, you know. And of course, in 35, we were both still in high school. So it wasn't the fraternity house for him, it was the attic. Later on, it was the fraternity house when he wasn't, you know, there. But it was kind of good. It was very good for me because I was shy, and I had, I thought I had the makeup to become an alcoholic because I was so shy, and I had a chip on my shoulder, and I don't know, it just seemed like things weren't going too well, and look back on it, of course, you see a lot of it's your own fault, you know. So.
So what kind of feeling do you just have?
I wasn't allowed to have any feelings. I got told to go downstairs on the Davenport. I went down on the Davenport. You know, those days you did what they wanted you to do. You didn't argue with them. And they said, the Davenport tonight, or if I smelled the formaldehyde coming in, I knew it was the Davenport. They didn't have to tell me. So it's just, it's just amazing. And, you know, when the book was written, we were writing it in the dining room in there, and they were all sitting around the table with a old yellow pad on their, you know, in front of them, and an old pencil, and trying to write their stories, and then when the book did come out, they sent it down to the, they sent it to Akron, and we couldn't afford to get them out of the station, so we kept them down there, and then as we would sell a couple, we'd go down and get a couple, and that's the way we got rid of the books. But Johnny, everybody was broke in those days. About time, Ross. Okay, next.
How'd you like that?
Very good.
That's
thank you, Sue. Debbie, can I have that? Sue is right. John does. He wanted to be here today, but he's in the hospital recovering again. He had to go back into surgery. He sends his love. So does Jackie. Our next speaker will be Kaz Lipinski with 54 years.
Thank you very much. My sobriety date is December 27, 1941. And with the help of God and people just like you in the meetings and the activities that we all should take part in, has helped to keep me sober one day at a time. I have to tell you that we have the 12 steps, and we have all the literatures and the big books, and of course the meetings, and the most important part of this program is to try to give it away to a suffering human being, be it man or woman, that needs the help that we had the opportunity to receive. And of course, you don't get everything that you want in a day or 6 months or a year. It takes a little while. It took us a long time to get here, and it certainly took us some time before we got our heads on straight. Even though they may not be perfectly straight, they're a little bit there. But however, I am grateful. I'm active. I go to meetings. I still help to sponsor people. They told me when I first came in here that I had to do the things that are asked of me to do, and I'll tell you, I'm still doing them. I'm a member of the Southeast Group of City of Cleveland, and tomorrow night we will be celebrating 53 years of sobriety. Actually, it was last week. It's the first week in November Southeast Group started. And I'm the only living person, of course. The reason is I came in when I was 24 and a half years old. Most of the people, when I came in, sometimes you hear talk about the gray hairs and about the bald heads and whatever, you know. Those are things that nobody has control over except God. And also, going to the first meetings, I can tell you that I didn't have proper clothes or things to do because liquor and beer and booze or whatever, bootleg whiskey those days, wine, took everything away from me, almost my life. And this program has given me my life back, I can tell you that. And I enjoy each day as though it would be the last, and I learned that in these rooms from the people that were here before me. I try to help. I help start groups. And I'm not looking for a pat on the back because there are many people here, and I'm not going to start naming names, that do an awful lot of things to carry this program forward, because when you're doing that, you're carrying and doing God's work. And you know, there are many who are not grateful enough. And when I say they're not grateful enough, it's so true. You know, they sober up in about a month, they're back in good shape at home with their wives, and their boss give them their job back and get about $3 in their back pocket, and they think that that's it. That's the world. Well, that's not the way it works. You know, this program works one human being helping another. Whether you pick them up at a dump or on the shores of Lake Erie or into the heights out into the beautiful homes that there are in all the areas, alcohol doesn't pick on any special people. We don't have to be down and out, or I should say nobody has to be down and out completely. We get them from the suburbs, people who were educated, but alcohol does not choose. Once we get addicted to the disease of alcoholism, it takes a toll on us, takes a toll on our minds, takes a toll on our lives, and we never realized it up until the time we were blessed with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll be forever grateful for the people that, my sponsor primarily, who felt that I needed help. And about 6 months previous to that, when he told me about a group that he had joined in with and he hadn't had a drink, he said, "I haven't had a drink in 5 months." Well, I said, "Jesus, about time you quit." You know, and I even said, "You old geezers, you know, you never look at yourself to see what shape you were in," or I was in, I should say. So he was 35 years old, and I called him an old geezer. It was time he quit, you know. But I'd be forever grateful for what he did introducing me to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have attended meetings. I still attend 2, 3, 4, sometimes 6 meetings a week. They talk about being active, you know, why. You're always active. That phone is ringing. I got a call two calls last night, so it must be that somebody still is looking for something. And I think they'll be looking for help long after I'm gone, and the many fine men and women who had helped keep the doors open. We try today. But you know, one of the things that you should always have is a sponsor. We're getting that static, but we are. Anyhow, your sponsor is there to help you to lead a different life. My sponsor and the people in the group that I went to at that time, Miles Avenue Group, they showed me a way to live. They told me that I could live one day at a time without drinking. God, I said, I'd be crazy, you know. I remember the nurse said to me, she says, "You've quit at least for a day," when she told me about quitting for a day, and I had to honestly tell her I can't remember any day that I've been sober in many, many years. And I was just a young youth, really, because I started quite young. But I'll be forever grateful. My children, my wife, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, which I have three, and one, God blessing us with one more great-grandchild. Who would ever think, as a result of being in this program, because when I was drinking, I smashed cars, I got into fights, I did everything that a human... I should rap on wood, it's wood here. I haven't smashed a car in almost 54 years now, believe me, and I haven't been in jail. I got stopped a couple of times for speeding, but I'm capable of talking my way out of the tickets. I even haven't even had a ticket. But the real meaning of Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life, and a way of life that once we start it, and of course we see some people that go back. I have to say that we are not judges and we are not God. Everybody does not stop drinking the first time they hit a hospital, the first time they go to 10 meetings or stay sober for a year. Some of them still believe that maybe a drink could help. Well, I've seen many people who thought, well, maybe a drink will help. You know, the old lady did this or something like that, you know, and I have my wife right here now. I can honestly swear to it that I've never called her an old lady, though she's getting along fine. But, you know, it's so true. It's so true. You know, when we're drinking, we used to use more than just old lady. You know, I've heard it time and time again. But we learn to respect another human being, be it your wife, relative, or whatever. We're all people, and we're God's children. And when I say that, I really sincerely mean it. I can tell you that I pray to God each morning to help me get through each day, and then I thank Him at night for the day. Not only for the day, but what I can do to go see somebody in a hospital or go and talk to somebody or answer the telephone and help somebody get through a day. That's the way this program works. We together can do it. One person can't do it, even though we've had two wonderful men who had started this program with the help of God. Somehow or other, they got together, and look what we have today. Worldwide, doing God's work to help another human being. You know, when we're in a saloon drinking, swearing, whatever, you know what he would be doing. I don't have to give you an inventory of my life, because many of you perhaps did the same or worse. However, today we get to be responsible human beings. We're caring. It's never too late to get up in the morning and answer that phone. The last one I answered was a little after 2 o'clock in the morning, and they had made arrangements to put this young lady, it happened to be a lady, into a hospital. And I said, well, I've got to go. And why did I say that? Somebody did it for me. Somebody did it for me. Those men that came to visit me in the hospital explained to me how they are living without drink. And, you know, they look so decent. They look, their eyes were bright and their clothes were pretty decent and everything, you know. And here I was, everything that I possibly earned and stole went for drink. And thank God that today I don't have to do that. I'm willing and able to help another human being. And I'm grateful for this meeting here today and the people that are here and these wonderful speakers that are going to be following me. Because I'm just introducing. I've said what I thought would be about proper for, except to add that I'm so grateful for all the young people that are coming into the movement today. Because if they stick with this program, and lived this program one day at a time as we were taught to do, they'll be entirely different. Parents, wives, husbands, sons or daughters, we change. And if we don't change, we better start taking that inventory and find out what's wrong. I don't know how long I've got, but I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to say a few words. And no matter what, don't take a drink. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. This is November Gratitude Month, and you can see in these people, all the men and women on this panel, they will show their gratitude. Debbie numbered this thing because she said, I couldn't count to 50 on the years over here, 40. But our next speaker is Art Hoffman from Ashland.
Well, Kaz, you must have read my script. What am I going to do to follow this one? I think I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Well, my sobriety date is May 20th, 1946. I spent my 30th day in a padded cell, 30th birthday, I should say. And I don't know, but something happened, and here I am. You know, I approach every day with a little prayer to all those individuals who took the time and had the patience and the tolerance to pound some sense into this German-Irish head. And believe me, it is something. Now, we all know how to drink, every single one of us sitting in here. And I'm not going to tell you how to drink. I've got my bottle story, and you got yours. I don't need another one, and neither do you. But I'll tell you what I'm going to try to do is tell you a little bit about my recovery. And you know who said this? The first and only time I met the gentleman, I'd been dry about 6 months. And I'm from the East Coast, and you can tell that from my lingo. But New York State and New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore and Washington was where I spent most of my AA life. I've been here in Ashland, Ohio for 7.5 years. And I'll tell you something. You can travel all over this country and on any other country you want to go to. And you never have to be lonely. Because there's always somebody in an AA meeting that holds out their hand and says, come on in and sit down and relax and enjoy yourself. And in Ashland, that's what I found. I'm an old knocker. I ran into Bill B. I ran into Johnny D. from Orville. I ran into the gals that we have. We have Bonnie, and we have Nikki, and we have Larry. They're all interested in service. And they've got 5 or 6 years, or maybe 2 or 3, I don't know. But I tell you what they do with me. They put me in the car. They don't have to dress me. My wife does that. They put me in the car and they drive me up here or any place I want to go, and they let me out of the car and they put me on a chain and they take me into the room and I say a few words and they take me home. Now those are the kind of people that AA people are. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like when I came to AA. But first of all, I want to tell you about the time I met Dr. Bob, Sue's father. We heard that he was speaking in New York State. In those days, we used to jump in the car and drive out and try to help people get out of work at 4:30 and try to help people start meetings. and groups and so on. There were only 8 groups in New York State at that time, and we were one of them, and there were 14 or 15 of us, and all men, no women, and nobody had any sobriety. The guy that founded the meeting was my sponsor eventually. The meeting was founded in 42, and it took him 3 years to gather 12 people around him. And we heard that Dr. Bob was going to be here, and we thought we'd like to see him because we had a problem. And that problem was most of us were fighting like the devil and trying to stay away from the first drink. So we drove to this town. Now, I've got 10 minutes to talk, so I'm going to make this as fast as I can. And he was standing in a corner, and there were some gentlemen, and just like his daughter said, he was very, very tall and thin and austere. And believe me, but he was very warm. And our spokesman said, you know, doctor, we're having a terrible time trying to stay away from that first drink. He got up on the stage, and he nodded his head, and he said, I understand, I understand. I've been there myself, and here's what you do. You do 5 things. The first thing you do, you don't drink. Now, that makes sense, doesn't it? Right. You don't drink. Booze. And any description. I don't care what it is. The second thing you do is you read the big book, because maybe you're going to learn something about how to cope with this disease of ours and get along with people. And the third thing you do, you go to meeting. This is where you exchange all kinds of ideas and thoughts and so on and so forth. And the fourth thing you do, you get a sponsor. Now, he said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, Bill W. and I sat in a room one time. And as a matter of fact, he said, it was the first time that I had met him. And I was going to give him 20 minutes to talk. But we talked for over 6 hours. And he said, we talked about booze and what it had done to both of us. And at the conclusion, he said, we made a decision. And this decision was that he could help me and I could help him. And maybe someday we could help somebody else. And you take a look today at from that little embryo. And as Kaz said, grateful for the fact that those two men met and decided to help one another. And from that little embryo, we can all be very, very grateful. Because there are millions of us today from that. And people like yourself. And my greater power that I finally decided was God. And because of those two men and many others, I've been here ever since. The fourth thing he said that you do after you get the sponsor, or the fifth thing, is you bring a positive attitude to the fact that you want to get well no matter what happens in your life. You're going to face circumstances beyond your control. You're going to face things that are going to happen that are going to be tragedy. But through it all, you don't drink. And you bring that same positive attitude to this program of life that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you bring a wishy-washy attitude, with a lot of yes buts, and I don't knows, and I'm too young, you're not going to make it. And that was the first night after 6 months that I got in that car, and we had an hour and a half or 2 hour drive to get home, 4 o'clock in the morning used to average. That was my first spiritual experience, right there. When that man turned my life around. Because at 30 years of age, as Kaz said, I didn't want to quit drinking. There was no question about it. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about me. Now this is going to take maybe an hour or two, but So relax, and Pete, you can sit down, and so on and so forth. But the first time I heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll compress this, I was in a padded cell in a straitjacket full of formaldehyde to keep from going into the jits and the gym jams. I was 29 years old and had been honorably discharged from Uncle Sam's service. I spent 3.5 to 4 years in the Italian campaign. And I was very, very sick. And somebody opened up the door and stuck his head in and said to the 10 of us that were in there, he said, anybody in here want to attend a meeting of alcoholics? Something. Please let us know. I spent 2 more trips into that padded cell. In March, I was in it again, and I heard those words again. And 10 days later, I was walking up this flight of stairs to attend my first AA meeting over a saloon, accompanied by 2 bodyguards, as I called them. One was 55 and one was 60. Now, in those days, we had no idea whatsoever that the call for help had to come from the individual. We pulled guys off bar stools, the wives would call, and so on. So we had no intergroup, and we didn't have any rehabs or drying out places to speak of. And the medical profession didn't understand us, so they couldn't help us. And the hospitals didn't want any part of us. And the whole picture of society was, hey, leave those drunks alone. They're worthless. And that's exactly the attitude that took place. Now, these 2 guys had come to visit me because I was being put away in Marcy State Hospital, which was the insane asylum of New York State, because I had been pronounced completely incorrigible and with a dead, dead attitude. And somehow or another, these 2 birds came to talk to me. And they were 55, and the other guy was 60. And I said to myself, just like Chaz said, what are you 2 old knockers doing calling on me? You got 1 foot on a banana peel, and the other one's in the grave. You're going to die pretty soon. For goodness sake, what do you know about a young guy and how he thinks? Well, they talked on, and finally they hit a nice soft point. They said, we've been in jail. Oh, I perked up, so have I. Now, what were you guys in for? Well, and where were you? Well, we were in Sing Sing, and we did 14 years. And I said, what for? Well, this one guy, Harry, said, you know, we were in the banking business. I was the bank embezzler, and Larry was the bank robber. And I said, well, how'd you guys happen to get together? Because they came out of New York, and he brought the big book along with them, and we could get out of our cells, and we could talk, and we could have cigarettes, and maybe even a cup of coffee. And I said, how'd you wind up here? Well, the parole board listened to somebody from this area, and down they came and said we could have a job and so on and so forth. Now, those 2 guys were the ones that saved my life, along with 14 other guys. I didn't stay in AA more than 28 days. In those days, you couldn't talk unless you had 60 days, consecutive days without booze. And the meeting consisted of one little guy sitting behind the desk, and he had a corked-up bottle of booze and a bellhop's bell and a watch. And at promptly 8 o'clock, he hit the bell, and he says, all right, this meeting will come to order. He said, my name is Joe, and I'm a drunk. And he says, you know the rules and regulations in AA, although we don't have any regulations. And I thought, what in the hell did he say? What was that? Anyway, and I'm all fogged up. Anyway, he says, you know, how many of you guys have got 60 days without a drink? And Six hands went up. How many went to talk? Six hands went up. He said, all right. Now, he says, you guys can talk for 3 minutes. At the end of the 3 minutes, I hit the bell and you shut up. And he says, if you get off the track, you shut up anyway. And new four guys back there who are half in the bag, he says, you keep your mouth shut, you make any moans or groans, that big guy on the door, and we had one who was 6'5" and weighed 260, and it's another story why he was there in the door, wouldn't let anybody in unless he recognized him. And furthermore, nobody could get in the AA meetings in those days in Upper New York State unless you'd been 35 years or older. Taz, you never would have made it. Not up there. Anyway, what had happened here in Akron and Cleveland finally drifted our way, and you know the rest. So I almost died, but I got out of the padded cell, and that was the end of that conversation. What I have learned is just exactly what Kaz has talked about. The one greatest, well, I can go one step further. These two guys were both killed in automobile accidents after I'd been in the program a couple of years, and I replaced him with another guy who was the founder of the meeting. And his sponsor was Bill W., and that's how I happened to know Bill W. as well as I did. And those are other stories, of course. But I did find this out as time went on, that the main goal, the greatest goal AA has for all of us, and there is no other greater one, is to become a whole person. Not a perfect person, because that's not possible, but a well-rounded individual, mentally, physically, morally, and spiritually. I also found out another thing, that the only way that I would possibly be able to do anything with this life of mine and gain freedom from alcohol was through the 12 steps of recovery, the 12 traditions, which were finally written by Bill and Bob for the purpose of putting some guidelines into this program of ours. Otherwise, it would have folded like the others have in chaos and so on and so forth. And being active as AA, as Kaz said, you stay active in AA from the time you walk in these rooms until the day that they carry you out. And Ross and I over here on the right were talking about this one time, 2 or 3 years ago, when we conducted a panel in Massillon, that our peers, the guys that came in and the gals with us, they don't come around anymore. And that's too bad. Because we have four examples to look at, every single one of us, to be grateful. We have that God-given endowment, the power to think. We have our greater power. We have the power of choice, and we have the power of example. And how can we help the people? That is our main mission. I sat in a room one time with Bill W., and these guys were all new Bill in a hotel room, and they said to him, hey, you don't look too good today. What's the matter? You look tired out. And you look thin. What's the matter with you? You still running around trying to get groups started here, there, and the other place? And he put everybody in their box, and he said this. You listen to this. It's my responsibility, as well as yours, to carry that message of recovery to those individuals who are willing to listen. And that's the name of the game. From that, you stay active. Look at this. People had to put this place together. Somebody had to make the coffee. Somebody has to chair meetings. Somebody has to do everything. Intergroup representative, and so on and so forth. And here we are. And I look out on all of your faces, and all the faces that I've looked at over the years, and I realize that we all got here more or less the same way. and more or less for the same reasons. And we're all under that common denominator, which is booze. And as long as we remember that this recovery of ours, that we can take no credit for this, that we practice honesty in every single day of our lives, and that we preserve the anonymity, which is a solid rock upon which this AA program of ours is built, we're going to be all right. Thank you for being just you. And I'm going to close with what a guy told me one time. He says, Arthur, I want you to keep breathing and keep smiling and keep living a sober life. God bless.
Thanks, Art. There's a lot of wisdom at these tables, but I'm going to have to get one of them cowbells I think Art was talking about. Our next speaker, Frank Salvo, 46 years, from the Akron area.
Thank you, Jimmy. As Jim told you, my name's Frank Solomon. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober 46 years. I'm 78 years old. I had my last drink when I was 31. I'm a native of Akron. I was born and raised here. These fellas didn't leave me much to say, I'll tell you. I was just thinking about that picture up there. You know, this is November the 12th, 1995. A little over 60 years ago, AA was founded. This picture depicts how they sat out there in the kitchen and discussed in what manner they were trying to start this program. They were laying the groundwork to help somebody stay sober, to help each other stay sober. Little did they realize that thousands of us would benefit from this program. I don't think they even realized how big this thing was going to be. As I said, they were laying the groundwork. And in 1935, I was laying my groundwork. I was supposed to be in high school, and half the time I wasn't in high school. And as I sit here today, if somebody would have told me back when I was 25 years old that I would have to go to AA to do something about my drinking, I'd have told them they were nuts because I could quit any time I wanted to quit. And probably back at that time I could, but I could never stay sober. I come from an ethnic family from the east side of town. I lived in an ethnic neighborhood when the country was dry and everybody made homemade wine and home-brewed beer and things like this, and I became acquainted with alcohol at a very early age. I used to have to wash your beer bottles to fill them up and things like this and help my dad make his wine. I never cared for alcohol as a kid. I would have rather had a bottle of pop. But as time went on, I developed a taste for alcohol. I can remember back when the country was dry and these people had parties and they brought their homemade wine and their homebrewed beer and how it changed their personality, how I would see a man who would run the kids off the street when he was sober, and when he was drunk he wanted to pat him on the back and you know, and talk to him and this and that. I could see how alcohol changed people as a kid. And I thought that must be a miracle liquid of some kind that would do that to people. I continued on my drinking, when I started to drink, and drank whenever the opportunity presented itself or whenever I went to a party or things like this. The upshoot of my drinking was after I was married and I had fathered three kids, and I'm fortunate to say today that my wife's still with me, and we've been married over 52 years, and we got three grown children. And it's all through AA that I've managed to maintain my sobriety, and they taught me how to live. I didn't realize too much, or I didn't care about what alcohol was doing to me. I thought when the time comes, I'll just quit, you know? When I drink too much and when it presents a problem, I'll quit. And little did I realize that when the time came and when it had a hold on me, that it was easier said than done. I just couldn't quit. My drinking ended up when I came into AA was a periodical drinker. My drinking consisted of maybe starting out on Friday night and maybe drinking till Sunday night or Monday morning, and I mean around the clock, because after I was married, my wife never knew when she would see me when I left the house. She would say, well, you probably won't be home for supper, or you'll be home for supper tomorrow or next day or sometime, you know. And I used to make me mad. That it'd aggravate me, and I'd say, that's not so. That's not so, but it was so. It was so. I've had problems with the law when I was drinking. I've been arrested for any number of different things due to drinking, due directly to drinking. I've been threatened. I've had guns shoved in my face where a fella threatened to shoot me when I was drinking. Had he been drinking like I was, I probably wouldn't be sitting here today. You know, I can remember the last time that I drank, and I don't never want to forget that. I don't never want to forget that. I was sitting in a bar downtown. I walked in there, and I wouldn't go to my old neighborhood and start drinking, because I used to say to myself, these guys already got a head start on me, and if I'm going to drink, I'll go someplace else and drink by myself. Then after I get enough in me, then I'll go and associate with them. And I went in this bar room this particular day, and I sat down, ordered a drink, and it just felt like gloom come all over me. Gloom, you know, like I was waiting for the death chair or something, you know. And I drank that drink, and as I was drinking it, I thought, I wonder where I'll wind up this time. I wonder where I'll wind up this time. Will I wind up in jail again? Where will I wind up? When will I stop drinking? When will I get back home? When will I go back to work again, you know? They had threatened me. I worked over at Goodyear Tire, and I retired from there. They threatened to fire me when I was still drinking. Forget it. I could see it as plain as if it happened yesterday. Walked into a saloon at 6 o'clock in the morning to get a drink, and neither one of us had any money. This fella had quite a bit of jewelry on him. We wanted to pawn some jewelry to get something to drink. The bartender didn't want jewelry. He wanted money. He finally gave us each a drink for a watch. We each got a drink, and we walked out, and I said, I'm going down this way, and he went the other way. And I went to a friend of mine that had a business place, and I walked in there, and I told him what I thought of him. And I told him to loan me some money. And he loaned me the money, and I said, you know what, you're the cause of my drinking. And he never said nothing. And I said, every time I come down here to see you and we go to over there to get a drink, I said, I buy a drink and you buy a drink and you get up and leave and I stay. You're the cause of that, man. You know, and he didn't say nothing. And I left there and I went and met my dad when he got off of work. And I was sick and I was shaking. I was in bad shape. And my dad didn't want nothing to do with me because every time he come down to get me out of jail, he would say, well, he says, where's your friends at? You got a lot of friends. Why don't they get you out? Well, the kind of friends I had, I wouldn't have bothered to get them out either. So why should they bother to get me out, you know? Anyway, I left him and I said, I'm going to do something about my drinking. And he didn't believe that because I lied to him so often. And I got in a cab and I went up to St. Thomas Hospital. Now, I had a younger brother that had been in AA 2 or 3 years before this. He had been out Sam Cummins' place. And I knew Sam Cummins was out there and he was doing a good job, but I don't know why I decided to go to St. Thomas. And I got in a cab and I went up there. I went in the front door up there and I walked in and I told a woman, I said, I come up here to take the cure. You know, we used to say call it the cure. And she said, sit down there. And I sat down. And when they came back to see about me, I was on the floor. I fell off the chair and I was on the floor. Now, being on the floor was nothing new to me. I'd been there thousands of times. So anyway, they picked me up and they put me in a wheelchair and they wheeled me back to the emergency ward. And I would go into alcoholic paralysis. I couldn't move my arms or legs. I couldn't talk. The only thing I could do was hear. And I could hear people talking. And somebody said, I wonder what's wrong with him. And somebody said, he drank too much. And they called Sister Ignatia down. They told Sister Ignatia, this fella come up here to take the cure. She said, he's in no condition to come in here to take the cure. She says, I won't admit him in here. She called some people down to take me outside. They took me outside, and they found out where I lived, and she called my wife up in the meantime, and she told my wife that they were going to bring me home, and my wife said, don't bring him home. I don't want him here. Take him anywhere else. She talked my wife into letting me come home, and I went home. And I stayed home 3 days to get sobered up so I could be admitted into the hospital over there at St. Thomas. She said, if he's able to walk in here on his own and say that he wants to do something about his drinking, I'll admit him. But he's in no condition. I can't even talk. And that's what I did. I spent my 6 days in there. It was a 6-day stay in there at that time. And the only thing that I wanted was to find out how to stay sober. That's all that I wanted. I wanted to find out how to stay sober. I knew that I had 3 kids. I knew that I was responsible for them. I knew without a shadow of a doubt that if they was going to get a break in life, it was up to me to see that they got it. I knew that. I didn't have to be told that. And I was determined to do that, too. And when I got in the hospital and spent my time in there, it was altogether different than it is now. They didn't have any nurses in there to speak of. The patients, the ones that had been in there the longest, helped those that were just new in there. They had a mayor and a sheriff that was the 2 oldest people in there. The mayor and the sheriff, and when they left the hospital, the next 2 oldest people were sheriff and mayor. Your job was to get the new people, and if they wanted something to drink, needed help to go to the bathroom, or needed help taking a shower, whatever they needed, you done it for them. You know, and I wasn't accustomed to anything like that. And I became the mayor. And somebody said to me one time, they said, up there, they said, that fellow over there wants a drink of water. And I looked over at him. He was shaking from head to foot. His head was shaking as bad as anything else. And I thought, how will I get that water in him? I got the glass of water, and I went over, and I grabbed him by the back of the neck and held his head still and got the water down him, you know. You know, that does something to you. That brings you down to earth, you know. They talk about humility and gratitude. They taught us that there. They taught us that there. You know, they talk about the guy that was in there that was well-to-do. He didn't wear the hospital pajamas. He brought his own silk pajamas in there and silk house coat with his initials on the pocket, you know. And he was a mayor and a sheriff. And he was supposed to make the coffee. And Sister Ignatia come in there and says, "Who's making the coffee today?" The coffee was gone. And he says, he raised up his hand. He says, "I make the coffee." She says, "How come the coffee isn't made?" He says, "I never made coffee in my life." And he said, "I ain't making any now." She said, "I'm going to tell you something." She said, "I'm going to leave the room here and I'll be back in 15 minutes. And if the coffee isn't made," she says, "you can get your clothes and hit the road." And he made the coffee. Yeah, he made the coffee. And every time that man talked anywhere, the tears ran down his cheek when he talked about that. She brought him right down to earth. She had a way of doing that. I learned a lot in there. They taught me how to live. They taught me how to live. They taught me how to live one day at a time. That was important to me. That was living one day at a time. They told me not to take the first drink, that the first drink is the one that got me drunk. They told me a lot of good things like that. They told me to help somebody else. And I've been trying to help other people. On one occasion when I was sober 6 months, a guy says, "You going with me to help somebody?" And I says, "I don't know what to talk about. I don't know what to tell him." We went over to see this guy. He was laying on a couch. I'd seen that scenario many times. He said, "I'm going to take him somewhere to get him sobered up, and you put his clothes away." This man had been a suit salesman, and he must have bought a lot of suits because they was all over that place. He said, "I want you to pick his suits up, match them together, and hang them in a closet, and clean the ashtrays all out, and pick everything up here." And I thought, what the hell is this? I'm not his butler. That's the first thing that went through my mind. But him and that fellow left, and I cleaned the room up, and I didn't feel any better or any worse for it. And I thought many times afterwards, had it happened when I was drinking, I'd have took them suits right down to Howard Street because I was close by there and I'd have pawned them, you know. I wasn't above doing that either. But I came into AA and I started going to meetings. And I was trying to do what I was supposed to do. And I think I had the right motives because all I wanted to do was stay sober and not drink today and try to help somebody else if I was asked to help. That's what this was all about. So, in my time in AA, I think if you do some good, speak about it. We're not here to talk about ego, and if I mention things that I've done, it isn't because I'm trying to build my ego up. It's because these things happened in my life the way they should have happened. I was sober 3 years, and another fellow and I started a group over in South Akron. That group's been meeting now for the last 43 years. They meet every Saturday night. Him and I had something to do with it, and God rest his soul, he's gone. You know, you do things like this. You don't do them for ego or being placed up on a pedestal. You do these things because that's the way it is. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what you're taught to do. Somebody ahead of me done the same things. Somebody that's coming behind me will do the same things. So I don't expect no pats on the back or nothing like that. I've got my just reward by staying sober one day at a time. And I want to thank you for being here. God bless you.
Thank you, Frank. Next speaker will be Tony Morales from Cleveland, Ohio, 45 years.
Thank you. You know, you can't get these Pollocks off 55th and Broadway, you know. If you look up here, you see, nobody has to ask if we're senior citizens. Just look at us. You know, I came to the meeting this afternoon, and Jeff and the one stuck me over with three women over there. It's hell to get old, believe me. And he says, oh, he wants to be with all the women, you know. Sometimes I'm home with my wife, you know, and I chase her around, we're home alone, I catch her, and I don't know what to do with her anymore, you know. You know, you talk about cats. I remember I sobered up, the first accident I had was in the cemetery. My wife's cousin died, and a guy asked me, he says, how do you get out of here? I said, just follow the road that way. He went that way, I went this way, and bang, we ran into each other, you know. And I'm going to tell you something I shouldn't be too proud of. You don't always learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. About 3 years ago, I played cards Friday and Saturday night. And we had this meeting here. And Jim Julian says, you want me to drive you? I says, oh, no, I'm okay, you know. On the way home, I hit the guardrail. I almost got killed, you know. Cost me a lot of money. So you don't always learn too well. Somebody asked me one time, did you ever go to the First International? And I thought about it. And that's when Sue's father led. And Eddie Hayes, my sponsor. John Watson, Harry Ryan, you knew all them guys. We were there. And it's the time that he said, let's keep it simple. Let's not louse it up. And I'll never forget them words. And I was new. I was only 6, 7, 8 months in the program. And when Sister Ignatia died, I was sober about 11 months, you know, no, 11 years rather, and Bill Wilson put his arm around me, and I was scared of him. He never done nothing to me. I never done anything wrong, you know. And he said, we need young fellas like you. And today that's what I think. We need young fellas in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Keep this place, you know. And I was at the Flame Group anniversary, and Kay Stewart says, you know, we're going to try and get Dr. Bob's house back together. Would you like to be with us? And I thought about it. And every third Thursday, we had to come here from Cleveland. I said, yeah, I'll come up. You let another fella come with me. So me and Don got on the committee. And I see all these people here. I remember on that table, we had, what, 5 or 6 people the first time. And some of them gone away, some of them did their job, and everything was wonderful, you know. Kept this place open. And then, you know, I thought, well, and on Founders Day, it's unbelievable the people that come down here on Founders Day. Larry here, he's from Cleveland. When I sent him down here the first time, he says he opened the closet door upstairs, and it was a guy on his knees praying, you know. Get guys from India, from Washington, from Spain, they come over here to doctor. And you know, there were so many people against us. Look at the place now. So many people against us because this is not AA. What is AA? What is Alcoholics Anonymous? Where did it start? Where did AA start? It started right here in this home. When her father and Bill were here and they wrote the book in the dining room and she said, you know, what, if that is an Alcoholics Anonymous, what is it? Isn't it nice to have a heritage when it's sober? You can come here whenever you want, bring your wife. I think my wife's been down here with me a lot of times. This is our home. And then Founders Day. Why do people come from all over the world here? Because the two men that started AA were right in this home. And I remember we were having meetings, and me and Don would be sitting on the porch, you know, and we're swinging on the porch. I'd tell Don, you know what? I could see Bill and your father talking, and your father would tell Bill, look, you're younger than me. You go get that guy, you know. Bring him back. And we had a lot of fun like that, you know. And we had a lot of arguments, you know, a lot of things about where Alcoholics Anonymous And then the meetings, like Art said, you know, it started here, started there. Art, I would have never made the program either. I was 26 when I came here. So me and Kaz Lipinski would be out on left field. Like, you know. And you come here, and I went to meetings, and like this, and a guy would walk up and say, what happened to that kid? He got hit in the face with a bar rag or something, you know. And, you know, too young to be in. You're never too young. And then today, you know, there's no generation gap. I don't think we had a generation gap at that time. And I remember one 4th of July at the men's group, and Chink asked me to lead, God rest his soul. And I said, no, I said, I'm not going to go up there. I'm new. I said, he says, you dummy. Nobody's going to come to that meeting. They're all on picnics. I said, really? First lie in his life, you know. So I go, and I lead the meeting, all these old-timers there, you know. Jim, and after the meeting, they said, well, he said, you know, maybe they didn't go on the picnic today. And the men's group, and the old-time groups. And the people, like Cass says, you know the 12-step calls. Well, I don't miss them. I hate when they puked in my car, I'll really be honest with you, you know. And my wife has always been good. She always cleaned it up, never said no. But, you know, you go over to somebody's house, and I'll just tell you about one in Warren. And it was, they had sobered up. When me and Don made a call on this lady, the couch was all wet, so on and so forth. And then they got married, they moved to Warren, they had three kids. And they invited us to leave. I forgot who led me or Don. And we had a dinner and everything. And it was a Christmas tree in the corner. The lights were out and the kids were so happy. And I was used to this because, you know, I'd seen this for a long time. Because my wife has never seen me drink. My kids have never seen me drink. I told my wife I belonged to the altar. She thought I belonged to the altar and Rosary Society, you know, and church. I said, we just don't drink anymore. Well, anyway, he took a drink, she took a drink, and I don't know whatever happened to the kids, you know. And just like Kaz and Art were saying, you know, the people that go out to drink again, and then you got some of them been around for 20 years, 20 years in and out, how good has God been to these people to give them another chance? I don't know. If I went out and took a drink today somewhere, somehow, if I'd have another recovery coming. It just happened. I sponsored a guy from the Knights of Columbus at 13 years, and Pete knows about it. I told him. His wife died. Well, he took a drink that one day he told me. Then the guy's telling me, hey, he's drinking, Tony. I said, well, nothing I can do about it. So I got to talking to him. All he, since his wife died in July, he's been home with a bottle drinking. So I don't think maybe you're going to sober up. Everything's going to be okay. And give a new guy a chance, you know. Sometimes they don't show up or they do. You know, I didn't agree with everything when I came in AA. I was going to go out the door and my sponsor would tell me something. I said, I get in the car. I said, you know what he can do? He can go jump in a lake, you know. Then I thought about it, but I come back. I remember the Cleveland Browns are leafless, but they started the great 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And all them guys, I told Eddie, I said, hey, I'm a football fan. I'm not going to no meeting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, jump in a lake, you know. At that time, I used to bet a farthing or two on the game, you know. And I got to make sure that they win or if they lose, you know. And, but the group is still going 20-some years later. And my sponsor belonged to the group, and Rube Mormon was the treasurer of the group. He says, he leaves the plug and the jug. And John belonged to the Conway group. And they like to play a little nickel and dime poker, which I loved. Man, I made that right away, you know. And people would get up and go to meetings, you know. But I'm so glad there's not too many of them left here to help start this place. But I'm sure you're here, Frank Solomon. You know, Frank, he's talking about this guy that died, you know. We used to go down to Gethsemane. This guy would drive 80, 90, 110 miles an hour, you know. And and I was sitting up with those guys. I'll never go with you guys. But then we get down there, we eat like hogs. Remember, the food was really good at that time, and we had a good time. I'm so glad to see a lot of young people come back here, come to Dr. Bob's house. Let's keep this place open. Spend a buck or two downstairs. You spend it in the bar, right? You got nothing for it but a headache the next morning, you know. This way you can get up and look at his T-shirt or a cup of coffee the next morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. Our next speaker is from Akron, Ross, with, 45 years.
My name is Ross Swinner. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. The drug that sticks in my mind, which I hope I never forget, I regained consciousness from a two-week drunk on July the 30th of 1950. I had entered Alcoholics Anonymous 3 months before. A bum on the streets, a wino, wearing the rags of a wino, my front teeth gone, the rest of them rotten. And I had been attending AA meetings for 3 months, and I decided I didn't like the way the people of Akron were running it, so I'd been drunk for a week. I spent the entire, well, part of the morning trying to get one gulp of cold beer to stay down, and it never did. Finally, some drunk from the neighborhood came up the steps to this bug-infested attic I was living in, and I told him to drink those few beers that were in the refrigerator. I can't cut them. I did know how to cold turkey off. I'd been a periodic drunk all my life. If it was DTs, I would just go ahead and have them, and my God, I've seen everything there is to see in DTs, and shake it out so I didn't feel. I'm glad nobody put me in a hospital because I didn't need one, because that was old stuff to me coming off of a drunk just like that. I don't know what happened to my buddy that came up the steps and drank the rest of the beers, but I haven't had a drink since, and that was 45 years ago, last July. I stayed until you got through to me this time. As usual, I could do all right for a while until it was time to get drunk. And boy, when it was time to get drunk, a periodic, I'm telling you, when it's time for him to get drunk, he has no choice but to get drunk, because every damn fiber in you is screaming for alcohol. But for some reason, I survived one of them, and survived another one. My God, one day, some weeks, some maybe a few months later, hell, I'm five drunks behind schedule. The only thing I was doing right, it was real white-knuckle crazy. I was dreaming of being drunk about every third night, it would seem. I still didn't think they knew how to run AA. But the only thing I was doing right, and I didn't know I was doing anything right, I was in a meeting room every night, just awfully near. And one night after a few months of sobriety, I did have me some store teeth, got my teeth all fixed up, taken off 40 pounds, had decent clothes on. Walked into the East Akron meeting. That's a bunch of tough old birds out there in those days in the East Akron meeting. And one of them said to me, how are you doing, kid? You've been around quite a few months now. I told him, I suppose you would think that I'm doing all right on sight.
I said, I'm in a meeting every night. I haven't had a drink in whatever a few months it was. Decent clothes to wear. I've got a good, pretty good job, making pretty good money. He said, what's the beef? What's the bitch? I said, well, it's those damn screaming, insane cravings I get for alcohol. And he said, well, said, you are a periodic. We've talked about that before. And he said, how much attention have you paid to this periodic bit? I said, I don't know. I've heard him talk about it, but I've always been one. He said, well, think about him. He said, have you had a lot of those cravings? I said, God, yes, I've had a lot of them. He said, have you had a drink? I said, no, I haven't. And he said, did you ever survive a drink before you came to AA? You've been in here for some months and you haven't had a drink. How many of them did you ever survive before you got here? I said, well, exactly none. And the first one that hit me after I got here, I got drunk. And now you have several. He said, well, what in the hell do you want? Oh, my God. And he got a couple over to help him, and they lit on me. I'm telling you, it was butt-kicking night at East Akron. I thought that mean old hellers of good God, get off. And thank God they did start the meeting, or I don't know what they might have done. But you slipped up and got me. This has been my life. My old Frank Solomon there was one of my original buddies in here. We were just about the same kind of drunks. He was one of my first meeting I ever led. I was scared to death. Frank, you're the one that put me on to do it. Life is ups and downs, good days, bad days. I live it one day at a time. A year and a half ago, I lost my wife of almost 37 years. Last week, I had a grandson killed in a car wreck down in Dallas, Texas. And, boy, you should have seen those Canton AAs. I live down Canton way now. They rallied around me again. They had me out to a meeting about six or seven last week, something like that. So we do take care of each other. I often think this room here, I met Sue and Bill Wilson here in 51. I was here with almost a year of sobriety. And it was Founders Day weekend. And they had open house here at Dr. Bob's. And that's where I met Bill and Sue. And I've been here many times since. Every time I look at this building, this house, I think what would have happened? I heard Bill talk in Toronto, and he said really the first seeds of AA were planted in Switzerland when Rollin Hazard came over from the States to have Dr. Jung, the world's foremost psychiatrist, work on him. He did work on him for a year, and he came back. He went back to the States and got drunk, and then came back to Doc again, Dr. Jung. What if Doc would have told him to get lost? Hell, I fooled with you for a year, now out. Where would we be? He wouldn't have been there to have met Abby Thatcher. He took Abby Thatcher, thought I'd better look up this guy Wilson if he's still alive and get him to some of these meetings if I can. So he came to see Bill, and he stayed long enough to light a fire under him. What about Bill's trip to Akron? What if Bill would have gotten drunk in the Mayflower Hotel? Where would we be?
What if Henrietta would have told him, I don't know of a thing I can do for you? Henrietta Siverling. Bill went to her. They called Doc in. They got together. They found Bill Dotson. Old Bill Dotson was a good friend of mine and Frank's there. Everybody did their job. Nobody fell by the wayside. Everything just clicked. Next thing you know, Bill was back in New York. AA groups in Cleveland. Then they started all over the country. To this till today. 2 or 3 million. On it goes. I want to tell you one little story, a little joke. I read it in an old grapevine that I got a hold of a year or two ago that came out the same month I got sober in 1950. Two drunks were drinking their way cross country and they got into Kansas, said we need a jug. They didn't know that Kansas had been dry for 100 years. So they asked in a little town, where can we get a drink? You can't get anything to drink in Kansas. We don't have it. It's a dry state. Finally, they came into a little town, and they saw something that looked like the town drunk leaning up against something. And he said, there's a guy that looks like he ought to know where to tell us to get a drink. So they called him over to the car and said, my God, man, where can we get a drink? And he said, well, you can't get them here because we're dry. He said, are you telling me that there's no way on God's green earth we can get a drink in this state? He said, yeah, there is one. He said, the drugstore will give you a small bottle of alcohol if you've been bit by a snake. And he said, the only trouble is we've only got one snake. He said, and if you want a drink, you better get over there to where they keep that snake, because if you don't, by the time you work up to him, that poor critter is going to be so tired he may not be able to bite you. Thank you.
Thanks, Ross. We're going to take, I think God, like Ross said, God had a lot to do with the part of Alcoholics Anonymous and the movement. We're going to take a tip. If everybody stays where they're at now, I see you have to use the bathrooms. Stay where you're at. We're going to take a 10-minute break. These people have been sitting down for a long time, and we're going to give them a break. We're back in 10. Panelists will be Joe Blaze from Cleveland, Ohio, with 39 years of sobriety. He also brought his bodyguard, Johnny.
Well, I know I'm in a special place because I am testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. My name is Joe Blaze, and I'm an admitted alcoholic. Hi, everybody. As I mentioned before, and I'll reiterate, I know that I'm in a special place. This is a place I am sure that was divinely inspired. I'm reminded of Dr. E.B. Hill. He was a prominent minister. He was invited to come down to Washington, and they requested him a copy of his little prayer because there was a business meeting and a dinner. And he said, I couldn't do that. I accept your invitation, but I'll not know what I'm going to say till I get there, and the Spirit moves me. Well, I know that the Spirit has been moving me ever since I got here. And it did the first time I was in the kitchen down there, you know, that I got such a sensation, it's an uplifting one that it's hard to describe and adequately let you know how I felt about it. But I know one thing, that over a kitchen on a table down there with a cup of coffee, the most important subjects of our lives were being discussed.
alcoholism and sobriety, you know that. And this is the way it started with me when I first came in. People invited me into their homes and sat me down at the table, gave me a hot cup of coffee, and began to talk, the exchange. And it started with Dr. Bob and Bill W. And how it proliferated from two people sitting at a table. All of a sudden, you got over 2 million people now in AA. That's the latest count. And in 143 countries. So you can see, as Dr. Bob and Bill indicated, pass it on. This is our responsibility. You may not think it means much, but the sum total of all of us together has a tremendous impact, and it touches many people and on different shores, you know that, as evident by the activity in AA as far as AA is concerned. We definitely are a society for sobriety and spiritual development. This is the name of the game. Tony indicated there are a lot of young people there, and I'm so ever grateful. I have a lot of them that are my friends, because this is our heritage, and heaven help us if we fail to preserve it, you know that, or neglect our responsibility to pass it on. And when Dr. Bob and Bill did that, gee, each other, and start carrying out the other of the first 100 men who are responsible for that big book, immediately they became cultural carriers of our way of life. This program prepared me for life, and it prepared me for death. I met many people that had a tremendous impact on me. I was immeasurably touched by the hand of AA. Most of the elders are dead. Most of them are here, right here, in this room right here, you know. They're the ones that carried the message, and they didn't shirk their responsibility, and they did what they had to do. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in AA. I don't think I or any one of us should be able to do it all. But neither are we at liberty to pass it by when it comes your way. When you start doing that, you're setting yourself up. You know, I see a lot of people backing away after years of sobriety, and sort of taking a sabbatical, you know that. And it's sad. It's sad because the alcoholic mind will does funny tricks on the alcoholic. I'm convinced that the thought of taking a drink never leaves you. You know that. It's not an active thought, but it. I have enough defenses by coming in these rooms that I know how to deal with these things, you know, and whenever the thought surfaces, I know how to put it down. I have a spiritual condition within myself, and it's been working real well for me, you know. The young people, they may have some misgivings about coming in at the early age. They figure they may have a lot of drinking left, you know that, and whatever the case may be, but it's so unnecessary for them to go out and qualify further for a program, for this program, the program of drinking, because we know definitely this is a progressive disease, and it's debt on the installment plan. Every time you take a drink, I read about in the papers, you know, your young kids, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, committing suicide as a result of the pressures, demands that are made of them, the way society is and all that. And this is not a kid's disease, what I'm trying to say. You know, once you get it, you got it, and it stays with you. You're not going to outgrow it, or it won't go away, you know that. And you better resign yourself to the fact that, you know, that, as far as you're concerned, you just can't handle alcohol, because alcohol handles you, and it handled me, and I know what it did to me. It drained my humanity, and it took away my ability. And it seems when I track back my record, and I was always dead in the track when I drank. You know that. You know, it's something that I didn't understand then. But as I came into the program, it was explained to me to people that
what it means to be an alcoholic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. To me, that means that that there's no exit, there's no return to sociable drinking, and to guarantee my behavior, you know that. And I just don't want to die drunk. I see too many people doing that. Young people, old people in between, you know that. Sister Ignatia said you're just a breath away from eternity, you know that. And I know that this program prepared me for life and it prepared me for death. And I stand before you the thought of the dying doesn't disturb me in the least bit, you know that. There's a lot of people that impacted on me in that belief and all that. They're here, people that, you know, carry the message. I know that I'm committed to this way of life, and I have sense enough to realize that commitment in itself doesn't necessarily make it a certainty. To make it a certainty, I must do something. No one's going to do it for me. They'll help you. They'll aid you. They'll do it in tandem with one another, but you still have to do the legwork. They're just like me praying to God, you know, that if I don't put a little effort behind it, then nothing's going to happen, you know, that there's no protection against adversity, death, disease, hardships, failure, rejection. All these things will happen to you, drunk or sober, you know, that. But I know one thing, the presence of a spirit within me, spirit that I picked up in these rooms, the God of my understanding, makes it all bearable. I can handle it now. Something I could not face before, you know that? I don't fall apart now under pressure when I used to, you know that? Or pull that almighty disappearing act, you know that? Whenever there's accountability or some responsibility, I sort of, you know, the back door, you know, sneak out, you know. That was my way. That was my... Now what I'm, my behavior now is uncharacteristic as the how I used to, you know, behave, you know. I'm a new person. I'm a changed person. I have a new identity. In me is every one of you guys, people, ladies and gentlemen here, you know. The sum total of my whole life is based upon what I learned in these rooms down here. They left their mark on me, you know that, and for that, I am responsible, you know. Whenever anyone reaches out the hand of AA, and I hope that I never shirk my responsibility when it comes to carrying the message. I just do what I got to do, you know that. And I know, all I know is I don't want to die drunk in the evenings. I just keep doing what I'm doing down here, living the life I'm living now. I have a God of my understanding. It's a God that, not the one I came in with, my understanding has changed completely as you got up here and shared with us how you came to believe. And so my God has many faces, you know, that images that makes me feel comfortable in any church, any synagogue, any denomination. I'm very comfortable. But I have to maintain that because, you know, my alcoholic mind, you know, it could take me back to that stinking thinking. Really, if I neglect it, that's why these meetings are so important. That's why the home group is so important. There's definitely a home group advantage, you know that, of becoming a member. People get to know you, you know that. You know, you stay sober together. It's a we program, and eventually, you cultivate new friends, new families. That's exactly. You're invited into their homes. You're eating food off the table. You're asked to partake in the family affairs. And the incredible thing is you didn't have to buy them a drink or fake it, you know that. You know, this is a spontaneous thing, you know. And this is the way it has been with me ever since I come in here, you know that. You are my other family, the family I never had, you know. I mean, and this is a loving family. I came in without a shame, a lot of guilt, and I was able to resolve it, you know that. If you come in with shame and guilt, then I'm sure you're going to have it, whether you're going to have to deal with it. And we got an answer to that. It's in the 12 steps, you know that. I'm convinced that the longer you delay getting into the 12 steps, the sooner you're going to relapse, you know that. Really, you know, because... There's no defense. That phenomenal craving is going to overtake you one of these days. You know, you can stay indefinitely sober, you know that? Without doing anything, just by coming to the meeting and associating. But that's not it. The moment of truth will come, you know that? And if you don't measure up to it, the big books, God can and will, you know, if he were sought, you know that? And these are the things. If you violate the principles of AA, you know, there are a lot of people coming in here, they look good, you know, they look good, you know, you clean up, you practice hygiene and all that, and new duds and all that. Yeah, but what I'm trying to say, the sobriety shows. But they don't show their sobriety by doing good for somebody else, you know that? Selfish, you know that? You know. And I see that, you know that? And it disturbs me, but one of the highest principles I have to live by is live and let live. You know, oh, that's a killer for me, you know that? Sometimes I like to force myself, but you can't do that, you know that? I know I came into a lot of reservations and resentments. I don't think there's a person in this room that doesn't have reservations and resentment. Even some of these old-timers that they probably still carry them. I don't know. But I'll tell you, it's impossible to remain sober with reservations and all that. And if you work the principles, you incorporate it into your life, as indicated in the big book, 12 Steps, the Absolutes, you're going to find out, you're going to grow spiritually and mentally, you know that. There'll be a new clarity, a new awareness, and a greater appreciation of arts, the classics, you know that. And this is what life's all about. We don't walk around with long faces. On the contrary, there's excitement in staying sober. You can go any place. I can go anywhere in the world and not feel threatened. You know that? AA has provided me with a trip ticket, safe trip, to take me there and bring me back. As long as I don't pick up that first drink. Because if I pick up that first drink, that'd be just like me going to Mexico, Donna. If the feathered lollies don't get me, the banditos will, you know that? I know that because I was there, you know that? I spent time, you know, in their Heights, they call it. They call it a Mexican Dobie jail. That's what alcohol took me down there, you know. When you compare jails we have here and what they have down there, you got a Hyatt here in the States. You go down there, you see a jail. I was ready to commit murder to get out of there. I'm not going to go into details, but that's what alcohol did to me.